it becomes a lot easier for a lot of teams to say, you can build on a layer two or layer three, but ultimately be secured by Ethereum, building the Ethereum ecosystem. And you don't have to sacrifice. You don't have to make those sacrifices today. Cause I get you. I get that it's like, it was like 10x more expensive. You're probably better off on an alt layer one because it's better for you. Like we get that. And I never judge a team for saying that, but our job was, okay, how do we narrow that gap? How do we meet people and say, okay, you can actually have your cake and eat it too. You can be an Ethereum, but you can also run a business and not have to worry about, you know, being outcompeted by someone else.
Hey, everyone, if you have been listening to Empire, you know that Santi and I are fed up with unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds that make the on-chain experience basically unusable. So the Arbitrum team reached out and they showed us the platform. They showed us what you can do on Arbitrum. Whatever you're doing, you can experience frictionless transactions at lightning speed on Arbitrum. So head over to portal.arbitrum.io and check it out. This episode is brought to you by Monad, which has not only the highest performance EVM L1 architecture ever built, but also the wildest and craziest community in crypto. Monad's internal devnet is live and public testnet comes out soon. So make sure you join the Monad community today at discord.gg/Monad, M-O-N-A-D, Monad. Are you tired of high gas fees? Well, I'm excited to let you know about Scale, a zero gas fee modular blockchain that's become a perfect fit for gaming and AI apps because of their instant finality and lack of MEV. Explore the Scale ecosystem today at scale.space/ecosystem and stay up to date with the gasless blockchain on X at Scale Network. That's at Scale Network. Big thanks to Scale for sponsoring Empire. All right, folks, we promised we'd do this episode. We got the episode lined up. We have Stephen Goldfeder back on the pod, co-founder, CEO of Offchain Labs. Stephen, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me. Great to be back.
Yeah. And if folks don't recognize the name, I'm sure they do. Offchain Labs is affiliated, associated with Arbitrum. What is the relationship there?
So we initially built the Arbitrum technology. Obviously today, the public Arbitrum chain, so that's Arbitrum One, Arbitrum Nova, are decentralized and controlled by the Arbitrum DAO and Foundation. But we are still a core contributor to the technology and are big believers in the Arbitrum tech and are building out Arbitrum Orbit and other programs that utilize the technology as well.
Cool. So I'd love to start with just almost a state of the union, actually. Santi and I were talking on the roundup last week all about L3s, and we were debating them and why do these things exist and didn't we just get L2s, and L2s aren't even there yet. Maybe you can walk us through like how we got into this world where now everyone on Twitter is talking about L3s and what are L3s and should we be focusing on them when L2s aren't even fully developed yet. Like, take us into this world of L3s. How did we get here?
Absolutely. So I think L2s, they definitely still, as you mentioned, L2s generally as an ecosystem have a way to go until they're sort of their final completion. Not that they'll ever be final. You know, people say to me, is Ethereum in its final state? And I say, no, of course not. So, but like L2s still have some, you know, development. I think Arbitrum is, that's L2s generally. I think Arbitrum is by far the most developed L2 from a maturity, security, ecosystem perspective, and just core technology perspective that exists today. But that's not to say that it doesn't have still things that are in the works, because it absolutely does. But the problem is, or the good thing I should say is, two ways to look at it, is L2s have gotten really, really popular. And you have this sort of desire or need for more block space secured by Ethereum, and more block space maybe where the applications have more control over the fees and the pricing. So I'll give you an example. You know, there are Arbitrum Nova is the gaming chain controlled by the Arbitrum DAO. And past couple of weeks, it's been doing like insane number of transactions. It's actually, you know, gone down a little bit now, but it was doing like by far the most transactions than ever any other Ethereum roll up or layer two solution. And what was happening was the fees were going up because of it. And this was sort of problematic for some games that were on there. They're like, hey, like, you know, I'm glad that you're succeeding, but like the congestion of the network is sort of everyone's paying for this resource. And some have said, hey, we want our own priority lane. We don't want to give up Ethereum. We want to be on Ethereum. We love the Arbitrum technology, but can we be in a chain that has our own sort of, we have more control over the environment, more control over the fees, and more consistency there. That's one area where we've seen some people that, you know, some push towards chains. You have chains, for example, like wonderful teams like Proof of Play building Pirate Nation, they actually are a team that went from Arbitrum Nova. We're doing fantastically well. Actually, they initially came from Polygon, went to Arbitrum Nova, and their fees were slashed by, like, I don't know, 30x or something like that. And then they said, you know, we're doing really well here. And now they actually have their own Arbitrum Orbit chain that they're using. There are also other places. So that's one. So it's like fees and predictability. But there are some other core features that have also pushed others that love Ethereum, love the Arbitrum technology, but want to be in their own environment. One is fee token. So there are projects that said, hey, I want to build a chain in which my token, whatever that token is the fee token of this chain. So you pay in this token. That's something that the Arbitrum Orbit stack supports. A good example of one of those, recently, there was a chain called DGen Chain. This is a chain actually not an Arbitrum one, but on the Base blockchain. So it's an L3 on Base. And they wanted to launch a chain with their own custom token. And they chose the Arbitrum Orbit technology, so the Arbitrum technology stack, to do that, because it's the only technology stack today that's customizable in this way that allows you to do that. You have chains like Rarity Chain that they want to enforce at the chain level, enforce chain royalties, create royalties at the chain level, and they can take the Orbit technology and do that. You can't do that on a public chain. It's just not feasible. It's not viable. You can't sort of build your app into the rules of the chain, but you have your own chain. You can get all the benefits of the technology, but also customize it. And I'll round out with just two more examples of, like, and just to give you sort of a flavor of the different types of customizability people are doing on Orbit chains. You have a team called Kinto, and they're focusing on institutional investors, and they are building sort of KYC institutional focused Arbitrum chain, an environment where institutional investors can use the Arbitrum technology, but in a sort of environment that they're comfortable with and can get all the regulatory comforts that they need. And then you have a chain called Phoenix. Here's Phoenix spelled with an F-H-E. F-H-E is also an acronym for fully homomorphic encryption, which is a cryptographic primitive used for privacy in this case, where everything on the chain is encrypted. And they are taking the Arbitrum technology stack, but not just using it vanilla and, you know, slapping a brand on it, but they're actually adding cryptography into the core chain logic and adding privacy there. So you have, like, this, like, wide range of uses for L3. Some are like, hey, you know, we just want our own customizability, or we just want our own branding on the chain, all the way to, no, we want to, like, KYC at the chain level and force create a royalty, or add, like, super deep cryptography into the chain level. And the unifying factor of all these is they want the security of Ethereum. So they want to be on Ethereum. And they also want to use the Arbitrum stack, which is the most advanced layer 2 or layer 3 stack. And they're able to do that by building a layer 3 blockchain on Arbitrum 1 or on Base, or, you know, or wherever they are, right? So you have layer 3s elsewhere. Some of these chains are actually building layer 2. So you can use the Arbitrum Orbit technology to build layer 2s, layer 3s. I'm sure one thing we can get to is, okay, so I'm a chain for one of these, like, many reasons. Like, I want to build a custom chain. Why L3 versus L2? I'm happy to get into that, but let me just pause here because I've been rambling for a while. I warned you guys before, I warned you guys beforehand that I can ramble, and I think I've proven myself to do that. So
I think our listeners would agree that two out of three here ramble. I want to get to, actually, you read my mind, that last piece. Can you go into that? The distinction between building an L2 using the AP stack versus an L3?
Yeah. So first I'll say a little history here, which is, the whole Arbitrum Orbit program is just about a year old, so a year and a month around. It launched in March of 23, which is when the DAO launched. And the idea was, together with that, it was community owned. I like to call it community sourced, right? So there's open source and closed source, but that's sort of a binary. It doesn't really exist in crypto, because in the regular software world, you have to make a choice, which is like, okay, do I allow people to use our software or do I not? And that's basically it. And you have in open source world, it's sort of a tragedy of the commons that emerges sometimes. You'll have, like, libraries that are used by, like, every big tech company, and these companies are generating, like, literally billions of dollars in revenue off this. And it's, like, supported by, like, 3 developers that can't get funding, right? So this is, like, unfortunately something that you've seen, and you'll find these bugs, and then you'll say, why was no one giving them any money and supporting this? And, you know, this happens over time and we start supporting more projects. But I think in crypto, you have a third option, which is, like, it doesn't have to be, like, fully open, which anyone can take it and not contribute back. It shouldn't be closed, which people can't use it. It could be what you call community sourced, which is, hey, you can use this, but you just have to become part of the community and contribute back and support its development. And that's where Arbitrum is. So let me explain what that means. When Arbitrum Orbit launched, it was just for layer 3s. On top of the Arbitrum blockchain. But it quickly became clear that, and that's not true. It was self-serve just for layer 3s, but if you wanted to build a layer 2, you had to go and ask the DAO for permission. It quickly became clear that there was a problem, because there was a lot of teams that wanted to build layer 2s, but also wanted to use the Arbitrum technology. They didn't want to sort of go and air their dirty laundry publicly. It's like, hey, we're doing this super secret thing, DAO. Can you vote on this? It's like, no, that wasn't working for teams. So now today there's a self-serve option for Orbit, which you can build a layer two chain or layer three chain, and they're all aligned. They all have some sort of alignment with the Arbitrum DAO. Either in the case of layer threes and Arbitrum one, you are building on the chain, contributing to the chain that way, or you're in the case of layer twos, you're explicitly asked to contribute back to the chain, to the DAO, to sort of support the funding of the chain and the ecosystem and the technology that you're using. But anyway, so that's sort of the history. So you can do L2s and L3s, both in an aligned way with the Arbitrum DAO. But the question is, why would a developer want to choose a layer two or layer three? So the answer is on the layer two side, there's some, I would say, people like the branding of it. Like there's a little bit of stigma still associated with layer three sometimes, where people are like, I don't want to be a layer three on top of Arbitrum or on top of some other chain. I want to be my own thing. I want to be my own layer two. Now there's some irony there, because even in a layer two, you're still like on top of Ethereum, right? And it's funny because if you go back 6 years ago, I had literally the same conversations with people one layer down. People said, what, you're building Arbitrum as a layer two? Are you crazy? Don't you want to be your own thing? Like you're just going to be always secondary to Ethereum. So today, like everyone's accepted that layer twos are quote unquote their own thing. And now that conversation has emerged on layer three, it's like, we need to be like an independent layer two. We can't be a layer three. So there's some stigma. And I'm not trying to like, you know, I clearly like don't think, I think that over time that stigma will go away, but I'm also not trying to minimize it. If a team feels that their community won't like that they're layer two, like, you know, that's their prerogative. And they, or I should say, if a team feels that their community doesn't like their layer three, then maybe a layer two is better for them. But there are some technical benefits and really some pragmatic benefits, I should say, of being a layer three. And there are several, but I'll just focus on two, because I think that they're really illustrative of you know, the core taste of why being a layer three is just makes so much more sense for a lot of teams. Number one is the cost of onboarding users. So say that you are a layer three block, or say you want to have your own blockchain and your users need to get their funds there. So you're a user, let's say in Coinbase, and you want to get your fund to this new app chain. Okay. So if you're a layer two, and let's assume also on day one, you're not going to have support where like Coinbase and Binance and like other exchanges directly onboard to your chain. You're going to have to go via the chain beneath you. Right. So Ethereum has support from all the top centralized exchanges. Arbitrum One has support from all the top centralized exchanges. Maybe your chain will eventually get there. And actually, we've seen Orbit chains get there. Xai, XAI is an example of an Orbit chain that does have a direct integration from Binance. It was the first one that got in. It's like a super big milestone. But like most chains won't have that on day one. So you have to think about, how are my users getting to my chain? And your users can be on Ethereum, they can be in Arbitrum, they can be in Coinbase. Let's just use the Coinbase example. So if you're building a layer two, what you'll do is you'll go to Coinbase and, hey, give me my ETH on Ethereum. And then I'm going to go over the bridge on Ethereum to new layer two chain. That's two Ethereum transactions, right? Coinbase has to do one Ethereum transaction that you're going to pay for. Then you have to do a second one on the bridge. Or the other thing you can do is build a layer three. And then you say to Coinbase, hey, Coinbase, give me my funds on Arbitrum One. That's a layer two transaction. And then from Arbitrum, you do another layer two transaction and go to your chain. So it's two transactions either way, one from Coinbase to the chain beneath you, and then one over the bridge. In the first case, you're doing layer two transactions. In the second case, you're doing layer one transactions. And it turns out that today, layer two transactions are something like 99% plus cheaper than layer one transactions, which means the cost of onboarding your users has gone down by 99%, right? So that's like the bottom line. If I've lost you in my like previous like monologue, the idea is 99% cost reduction in onboarding users, because rather than have to do expensive Ethereum transactions, you can do cheaper Arbitrum One transactions. And that actually makes a lot of, you know, will actually matter for a lot of people. So that's reason number one. Yeah. Let me pause there.
Well, I believe you have more reasons. On this point on user acquisition, how do you envision that playing out over the next, you know, next year or two, where bridging and connectivity between these chains just becomes far easier, presumably?
It's a really interesting question. So I think bridging and connectivity between chains will become easier. And in fact, that's something which we at Off-Chain Labs are actually actively working on, which is better interop technology. We called it Arbitrum Orbit, you know, to signify like the chains are like moving together and they're coordinated. It's not just like random chains in the atmosphere. And the idea is that over time, as you mentioned, interop will get better and better. That's from the work that we do. That's from the work that partners like Espresso do. That's from the work like bridging projects like Layer Zero, Hop, Connects Across do. You know, there's a lot of different people that are sort of eating away at the same problem. And the result's going to be, fast forward in a couple of years, we'll have much better interop. That being said, interop between new chains will always be a little bit harder, right? So what I mean by that is, like, some of these features will just be, okay, you're building an orbit chain and you get interop, and we're working on those things. But some of it will be like, you know, layer zero has to support you, or like Espresso has to support you, or, you know, or some piece of infrastructure has to support your chain. And the idea is there, like, you're always still going to think about, like, the same way you'll think about, well, eventually I'll just have centralized exchange integrations, but you're still going to think about, like, okay, but like, how long will it take for infrastructure to support my chain? And will I be able to survive that period? Right. And that's sort of, and sort of the cost of onboarding, particularly in the early days, I think is not going to fully go away, even as bridging gets better. I think eventually it will. Eventually it'll be at a point where any chain, you can just launch a chain and it's greatly interop. But I think, you know, we're farther away from there than to a point where, for the selected chains that these partners select, you know, choose, you'll have better interop between those. And then the question is, okay, just like, eventually I'll get centralized exchange support. Eventually I'll get better support as part of this. And again, we're working away at this problem to build general interop, but I just don't think that it's going to get to, like, you know, zero costs soon.
I think you were going to go into more. Number two, number three, number four.
Yes. I'll just do number two for now, which is, and the second reason is, chains have to post data back to Ethereum. And it depends how they're configured. They might post all their transaction data to Ethereum through a rollup. Maybe they'll send some of their data to a data availability committee like Arbitrum AnyTrust, or maybe they'll send it to, you know, EigenLayer, Celestia, Espresso, any other of the, you know, DA avail, you know, DA solutions that are coming online. But in any event, you're going to have to post data back to Ethereum. You're going to have to post either the actual transaction data or some representation of the transactions data is back to Ethereum. And it turns out that in any case, there's a fixed cost of going back to Ethereum, right? So it costs money to go back to Ethereum. And there's like an overhead essentially of posting to Ethereum. And if you are a, you know, if you don't have many transactions, it's actually going to be pretty expensive. Like if you're doing like transactions like Arbitrum One, which is tens of transactions per second, okay, it doesn't really matter, right? The overhead is going to amortize away. But if you're like a new chain, it's going to have spiky usage or spotty usage. So you might have like 100 transactions during this minute, and you'll go like 10 minutes without a transactions, or maybe overnight in whatever region, you know, you're not popular in or whatever, you'll have lower transactions. You're going to have times where you have very few transactions. And but you know, if there's one transaction that comes in, but they have to, but the cost of posting just the blob to Ethereum is a fixed cost of like $50. It's going to start, you know, getting really expensive either for you or for your users. And the analogy I like to use here for layer threes versus layer twos, layer twos is taking the car over the toll. So you have to go, you know, might be the only person in your car, but you have to go over the toll, go over the bridge, pay the toll, and that's going to be expensive. For layer threes, you're actually going to take the bus. And what that means is you're not going to Ethereum yourself. You're just talking to Arbitrum One, and all of your data is getting packed together with all the rest of the Arbitrum One chain and all the other layer threes that are doing the same thing, and you're going to Ethereum. So it doesn't matter like if you have spotty transaction, because you just need to buy your bus ticket. And that's sort of, you know, would be my most two compelling reasons. So to wrap them up, it's, you know, 99%+ reduced cost of user onboarding, and take the bus to Ethereum rather than the carpool lane, which is going to be really helpful, especially when you have one person. You don't want to drive a bus in with one person. You know, you sort of get on the bus to everyone else.
From value accrual to Arbitrum, and maybe by extension Ethereum L1, does it matter? Like, how do you think about the, like, teams using an L3 versus an L2? What's more beneficial for value accrual to you guys and then to Ethereum?
So this is basically what I was sort of hinting at before when I mentioned like alignment with Arbitrum and community source. I think it's critical that whether you're building a layer two or layer three, I think the Arbitrum ecosystem should be agnostic, right? It should want to support you in whatever's best for you. And the way to get it agnostic is to sort of give it, you know, make sure that you're contributing back in either way. So in the layer three case, if you're building a layer three at Arbitrum One, you're actually not asked to give anything explicitly. The idea is, you know, Arbitrum One is sort of your hub. You're transacting via Arbitrum One. You're settling onto Arbitrum One, so like, or Arbitrum Nova, and therefore, you know, free to use, free to customize, do whatever you want, and you don't have to, you know, contribute anything explicitly. In the case of, hey, you're taking the technology and building a layer two on Ethereum, which isn't necessarily contributing back to Arbitrum One by its own nature or anything, right? You could just be, you know, it could be a competitor's chain says, hey, we like the Arbitrum technology. We're going to compete with Arbitrum One using its own technology. or you're building a layer three on a different blockchain that's not controlled by the DAO and the DAO doesn't get the fees for, that's, I think, where you know, you have to build these sort of explicit alignments. So the way that the what's the Arbitrum license program is set up, if you want to build a layer two or you want to build a layer three elsewhere, you're asked to contribute back 10% of the chain's, you know, net revenue. So like you take all the everything you paid out on layer one and subtract that, you don't pay that, you know, your costs, whatever your sort of L2, you know, profit, if you will, chain's profit, it gives 10% of that, you know, 8% to the Arbitrum DAO and 2% to the developer guild, that sort of, you know, this group of developers that will hopefully emerge and, you know, it's open actually for teams to join that are building the core technology just to make sure the technology is funded. And the idea here is that it's fully customizable. You know, the meme is Arbitrum is freedom, which is you can take the technology, you can do what you want. You don't have to ask anyone for permission, but you do have to either explicitly or implicitly contribute back to the Arbitrum DAO, contribute back to the community that's building it. No one's stopping you. You don't need anyone's permission, but you do need to contribute back. But the interesting thing is if you're like, hey, I want to build a layer two, but I don't want to contribute back, you can go to the Arbitrum DAO and ask for a special case. You're like, hey, can you like let me build a layer two and I only want to give 9%, not 10%. Like you can go ahead and make your case to the DAO. They have the ability to, off-chain technically does too, but you know, we don't intend to, you know, we'd much rather, you know, have people go through the DAO route. That's, you know, seems much more community aligned. And the idea being that you go to the DAO, you can ask them for whatever special deal that you want and they can consider it. And, you know, it's really up to the DAO.
How enforceable is that?
In terms of like
explicitly or implicitly, is have there been cases where someone uses your stack and just kind of doesn't pay? Like, how are you enforcing the 10% at the contract level? I assume not. It's more like soft.
I think, you know, it's early days, so I don't know of any cases of teams that haven't, you know, complied. But I imagine that any reputable team or any team that sort of, you know, wants to build something interesting and build something community, you know, it will build something for the community will comply. And that, you know, all early signs that I've seen, and again, I'm a lot of this goes through the DAO and the foundation, so I'm definitely not privy to everything, but what I've seen as part of the community is that teams definitely, are interested in you know getting a license, and this is something that's like always the case. Like, sure, it's possible someone somewhere, you know, will take the code and not comply, and then, you know, it's up to the DAO and foundation to figure out what they want to do about that. But like, I think that most reputable teams will want to comply, and particularly here when you know it's not like it's going to the community, right? So it's not going to off-chain labs. It's not even like going to actually to the Arbitrum Foundation. It's going actually directly to the 8%. 2% is going to the Developer Guild, which hopefully will build up to many teams. But 8% is going directly to the Arbitrum DAO's on-chain wallet, right? So you're going to see this interesting thing, which is today the Arbitrum DAO's wallet has like a ton of Arbinet, also a ton of ETH. Because there's like, if you look at last year, just like the chain profit was like $50 million in ETH. So a lot of ETH, billions of dollars of ARP. And you're going to start seeing all these like weird tokens, if you will, like going to the, because like, remember, some of these chains are collecting fees in their own tokens. And so the Arbitrum DAO is just going to have this like interesting on-chain portfolio that the DAO itself can vote on how to spend. So it's like very, very transparent. Like, it's hard to argue and say, hey, you know, we don't want to contribute back to this core community that's funding the technology of the chain. It's not like you're enriching a particular individual. You're literally contributing back to the community and saying, hey, guys, you know, we spent years building this tech. It's community owned today. All we're asking you to do is just, you know, contribute, you know, you keep 90% of it, just contribute back something to the sustainability of the community and align with the community, or do it implicitly, or just build a L3 at Arbitrum 1. That's another, you know, option which you can do. Or if that doesn't work, go to the DAO and ask for a custom deal and maybe they'll give it to you if you have a case. But I think there's just so much optionality and flexibility there that I think it's, you know, most teams will find an option that works for them.
Steven, how do I make the decision? Let's say we wanted to launch Blockworks, some Blockworks app or whatever. How do I make the decision between just building an app without a chain, just building an app on, you know, whatever, on like an L2 or an L3, versus building an L3 versus building an app chain, like something like DYDX has done? How do I make that decision?
Yeah. So that's a great question. So number one is the question you should ask yourself is, do you need a chain? And, you know, we sort of like, when we started, gave all the reasons that people might want to customize a stack, you know, to have their own chain. But the truth is, for many applications, they don't need their own chain. They don't need to worry about infrastructure. They might want to be on a chain with someone else. Like if you're a DeFi app today, you're going to want to be an Arbitrum one. You're not going to want to like launch your own chain, have fragmented liquidity, et cetera. Even if you have great bridging, you're still going to have some degree of fragmentation. So number one is the question is, do you have a compelling reason to launch your own chain? Right? There are some out there that are sort of trying to push everyone out to their own chain. I don't think that makes sense. The way I see the ecosystem forming is there's going to be the general purpose chains that are long-term relevant, long-term very important. This is where Arbitrum One is leading today. And then there's going to be the application chains or chains where, you know, for applications that it may, and it could be ecosystem chains. It could be like, okay, we're building a gaming chain. It doesn't have to be a single application, more special purpose chains, if you will. So that's the question, which is like, why are you building your own chain? And does that make sense? And you might have a good reason, but you should be able to articulate that reason is number one. And then the question is, okay, so I want to build my own chain. What do I do? And I view L3 and app chains as actually very like, you know, basically the same in the sense of the L3, if you take the Arbitrum Orbit technology, you can do whatever you want on the chain, but you can also sort of customize it as you want, and you can restrict it as you want. So for example, if you want to say, hey, we're building the Blockworks chain, but, and I'm not trying to, you know, I have no knowledge here. So just spitballing here, but we're building the Blockworks chain. And, you know, but we actually want to restrict it that only Blockworks can launch apps on the chain. Like imagine, like it's an open chain, permissionless chain. Anyone can go ahead and use it, but like these are the only applications on the chain. So you can actually restrict it in that way without compromising the secured by Ethereum part, without compromising the anyone, any user can interact with it. And you can basically have, you know, a more restricted application in there. And why might one want to do that? Because you might say like, well, I really want to control, you know, the congestion of the chain. So I don't want someone launching, you know, something else on the chain. And then like all the Blockworks users get congested because this other random app that doesn't even belong here, like is now using up all the block space. Or you can be like, that would be awesome. Like, I don't care who builds here. We just want it to be Blockworks branded. That's fine too. But my point is you have a lot of customizability with the Arbitrum Orbit stack. So I would say, you know, the difference between open L3 versus like app chain is very much how you configure the stack, but it's the same stack.
Mm. Is it fair to say this might be an overly broad categorization, but the L2 is for kind of general purpose scaling and L3 is more for, I guess you could either say customized functionality or customized scaling?
So that might emerge in how people are using them, but actually like from a core technology perspective, the L2 stack and the L3 stack are on the surface, like on terms of the developer and user surface, literally identical. Right. So there's nothing you can do on an L2 that you can't do in an L3 and vice versa. So that from an ecosystem development perspective, we may very well see that those who have a more broad vision to have, you know, it'd be a general purpose chain to be like, okay, we're going to be a layer two because we think that that's like how you position yourself for a general purpose. And those who have a vision to sort of be vertical specific or application specific might tend towards L3. Although we've seen a lot of L3s that are very broad in their ambitions. You know, you have, for example, in gaming, Arbitrum has a ton of gaming L3s that are not just that one game, but are actually sort of, you know, looking to build gaming. You can think about like game publishers where they're, you know, attracting. You have like Treasure Chain, Zai, Ape Chain, Muster, Hytopia. You know, there's like 10 or so different gaming chains in the Arbitrum ecosystem as an example. So that might emerge as a pattern of usage, but from a technical level, there's like any chain that's built as an L2 could be built as an L3. Any chain that's built as an L3 could be built as an L2 technically.
If I'm playing this out far enough, like not next 1 to 2 years, but like 5 to 10 years, if I'm in Arbitrum's shoes, at some point you got to consider actually, this is going to maybe seem crazy, but getting off of Ethereum. And I'd be curious if you've thought of like how you think about that as an L2 and like how you think, do you think that L2s and Arbitrum specifically or anyone else will eventually try to launch their own L1 and basically say, look, we use Ethereum for security today, but we don't need that anymore.
So that to me would be like a big violation of like everything, you know, that I care about and the reason we set things up. I can tell you, earlier I alluded to, you know, this whole conversation we're having now between L2 versus L3, I had L1 versus L2. So, you know, to give you a little more context there, that was in the context of like 2018 fundraising. When we were trying to fundraise, say, hey, we're doing this like radically new thing at the time. We're building a layer two blockchain. Like, who else is doing that? A general purpose layer two blockchain. No one else was doing that at that point. And then we were raising funding for that. And we saw a lot of pushback, which, you know, particularly from investors, some investors. Obviously, we found some really great investors that believed in the vision, and here we are today. But we had some, you know, investors and some very smart people push back and say, like, it doesn't make sense. Like, you know, you should build your own chain. Why would you always be, you'll always be subservient to Ethereum? That doesn't make any sense. What are you doing? And our response was like, and it's very aligned with what later became Vitalik's roll-up-centric roadmap, which is, no, we believe that Ethereum has, you know, is the most secure and has the strongest story to be that security layer and be that secure blockchain. We also think it needs to scale, and that's the and that's what we want to do here. So, you know, my point is, like, it would have been a lot easier to just start there and build a layer one. Today, that seems funny because layer twos are all the rage and all the layer ones move to the layer twos. But, like, it was always a principle-based decision of, we should add to scale the scalability of Ethereum because we believe in Ethereum's security, because you believe in Ethereum's decentralization. So I personally would fight very hard against, I'd be very against, you know, chains like Arbitrum becoming their own blockchains. I think Ethereum is contributing a lot to them. And I actually think Ethereum, you know, is also doing a lot to reduce its fees and its costs to make this environment more competitive for rollups, to make it that rollups, what I mean with that is, you know, an environment where rollups can use Ethereum for security and compete more. But the other thing is, I do think that we have to be careful as an ecosystem because, yes, there definitely probably will be chains that realize that, hey, they can bootstrap as a layer two, gain a community, and then sort of, I'll say rug, you might agree or disagree with that term, but like, you know, sort of, you know, drop Ethereum. I think that that's a very dangerous thing, which is why, like, I've always been an advocate of, like, hey, guys, we have to, and I'm not suggesting that any particular, you know, other chain is doing this today, to be clear. I'm not like pointing fingers at anyone, and I have no knowledge of anyone that is. I just think as we proliferate to 20, 30, 40, 50, hundreds of chains, you know, will one of them have this idea? Absolutely. And that's why I think building out the core security, it makes a lot of sense. Because if you're Arbitrum today, you're like, hey, we've been, you know, this chain has been posting fraud proofs on Ethereum, has been like actually secured by Ethereum, you know, since its launch. Where if you take another new chain that launches today and it doesn't have anything security, you know, anything related to security Ethereum, it's a lot easier to go to your community and say, hey, you know, it turns out we're paying all these extra fees to Ethereum, but it's actually not providing us anything in this case, because, you know, some rollup might not have the core technology that actually provides it. So that's a lot easier to go and say, hey, let's turn that off. But if you're actually getting the benefit of Ethereum, I think it's harder to make that argument because I think there's a ton of value from there. So again, I'm not suggesting that any chain that I know of today will do that or is doing that, or I suspect them of doing that. But I do think that as you have chains that are not actually benefiting from Ethereum, but are paying Ethereum for a service that they're actually not utilizing, that is something which we as a community should you know, be careful about and make sure that those that are actually building on Ethereum are, you know, actually getting the benefits of it and have a community that cares about the benefits of it. And if they don't, then they can go build a layer one. But, like, you know, anyway, that's my thought, mm-hmm. which is I'd be very against Arbitrum or any other big layer two doing that. I think Ethereum provides a ton, and I think it's worth the premium that you pay for Ethereum security.
How would you articulate the main benefits of building on Ethereum? And could you point to certain examples where a chain, not Arbitrum, may be using Ethereum, but may not be getting the benefits that you are getting?
I think so. The core benefits of using Ethereum are, there are actually two. Number one is the security, right? Security and decentralization. So actually building a layer two and actually being secured by Ethereum. And that means it could be a validity rollup, like a ZK rollup where you're posting proofs to Ethereum and having Ethereum verify them, you know, ZK proofs. It could be an optimistic rollup, like Arbitrum One, where there's a fraud proof mechanism that if engaged will get resolved on Ethereum. And that's where Ethereum is, you know, and also chains like Arbitrum One that are actually using Ethereum as a data availability layer, where Ethereum is actually giving guarantees. It's a lot cheaper today because of 4844, but still Ethereum is providing that core service. I think that's where these chains are using Ethereum, and they're actually benefiting from it. And it's a type of benefit, like, you don't think about it on a day-to-day basis, but, you know, as there's a proliferation of new chains, trying new things, eventually you'll understand, you know, we'll see, so, okay, like, I see what happens, you know, I hope nothing goes wrong ever, but, like, the point is, having security is a thing that, like, you don't appreciate until you actually appreciate it, until you need it. hopefully that time never comes for any chain, but I think it's something that's worth paying for and something that I'm very, very supportive of. And you get that by actually having a proof system on Ethereum, data availability on Ethereum. That's not to say, to be clear, that I'm not a favor of, I don't think there's a trade-off space. I'm not anti at all the data availability space. I think, you know, we even in the Arbitrum ecosystem built Arbitrum AnyTrust, which was probably the first live alternative DA. And there are a lot of great teams like Espresso, EigenLayer, Celestia, Near, Avail, you know, really a lot of them, Zero Gravity, a lot of these teams that are building alternative DAs that I think they're have a point. They have a, you know, there's a point in the trade-off space where it makes sense to use them. And, but I just think there's a gamut of services that Ethereum provides. And in the case of Arbitrum One, it's data availability and also settlement and just core security that if there's some dispute, Ethereum will referee that and resolve it.
Fair to say that if you don't have fraud proofs, you're not getting any of the benefit as a user from the security of Ethereum L1?
Yeah, you may still be getting the DA. So those are, you might still be putting your data on Ethereum, so you know your data's there. But if you don't have fraud proofs built out on Ethereum, there's going to be a centralized, generally centralized in the ones that I've seen, a centralized, let's just call it entity or sequencer in this case, that basically decides the state of the chain. And if they decide to be dishonest, or if they get hacked in some way where someone else decides to be dishonest, that now is now empowered, you can't go ahead and say, hey, Ethereum, like, this is clearly wrong. The rules don't allow this. Can we resolve this? Because that mechanism just literally isn't there.
Can we go into this? Because you and I have talked about this at length. There are certain L2s that don't have fraud proofs, and they've been deployed for many years. Or just been around for a while or securing a lot of value. You guys, what is it about fraud proofs that makes it so difficult to build and to deploy? And then contrast that to centralized sequencer, because I think people conflate the two. They're vastly different in my opinion. But let's go down this rabbit hole.
Yeah, absolutely. So fraud proofs are actually kind of funny because on the surface, they're like very, very simple. Like you look at like ZK proving and you look at fraud proving, and fraud proof just looks very simple, but there's a lot of different edge cases and protocol cases that make them, you know, very delicate. And, you know, we've been studying these systems for years now, you know, close to a decade actually from the earliest days. And there's still things that we're learning and figuring out. You know, Arbitrum Bolt protocol is a really nice protocol, but that's like, you know, the third or fourth generation of Arbitrum fraud proof protocols. And there's a lot that we figured out along the way. And there's a lot of, you know, tricky cases and gotchas. So there's definitely a lot of complexity in figuring these things out. It's a lot more the nuance of the protocol, you know, and different classes of attacks that could happen and what happens, you know, if some bad actor comes in, how do we know that the good actors can win? Are there any edge cases? That's where a lot of the complexity comes in there. But, you know, to your second question, there are two roles in the Arbitrum ecosystem, or really in any roll-up ecosystem, that people often confuse. And I'll use the Arbitrum terminology, but again, in any optimistic roll-up, these are two roles that exist, even if they're called different things. One is the sequencer. And the sequencer's job is to, as you said, sequence transactions. Right, so it orders transactions come in, the sequencer sort of gives an ordering. And the sequencer posts those transactions on chain, it posts these batches of transactions on chain. There's a second role called the validators. And these are the ones who actually provide the security of the chain. And these are the ones who will engage in the fraud proof system. So what the validators do is they don't actually talk to each other. They don't even talk to the sequencer. They just look at the chain and they see this feed of transactions the sequencer is posting. And they sort of execute it and get the result. And one validator goes ahead and posts the result on chain. And the other ones say, do I agree or disagree? If they agree, they do nothing. If they disagree, then they'll go ahead and like engage in the fraud proof mechanism to come out to the right decision and figure out what the correct execution is. But the idea is that the validators keep everyone in check, including the sequencer. All the sequencer is doing is it's posting the transaction routes on chain. It's not telling you what the result is. It can't take money out of your wallet. It can't, you know, post a bad transaction. If it includes a bad transaction, or it'll just get ignored by the validators, right? If the sequencer is kept in check by the validators, the sequencer is just sequencing and ordering transactions. Now, people always say decentralize the sequencer, and there is something to be decentralized there, and I'll get into that. But there, I think a lot of time people misunderstand and think when you say decentralized sequencer, they think the sequencer is the dictator and can do everything. In actuality, there's the validators that keep the sequencer in check. In the Arbitrum case today, there's about a dozen validators, including like larger institutions like Google and Consensus and Off-Chain Labs, right? So Web2 and Web3, big players that are validating the chain. And the goal with Bold is to open this up to everyone. But even today, there's already a really nice distributed set of validators. You just have to trust one of them. And, you know, as long as you trust that all these 12 don't go ahead and collude, you have, you know, Ethereum Foundation in there. You have a lot of different, like, you know, representations of really strong companies with strong beliefs. Again, opening up is better, but Arbitrum today validation is already distributed. The sequencing is still centralized. And what that means is this ordering is centralized. So what does that mean? It means the Arbitrum sequencer, if it wanted to reorder transactions, it could do that. It doesn't in practice. It does a first come, first serve ordering, but it could go ahead and reorder transactions. Can it censor? It can delay you, but it can actually censor long-term because you can always go on-chain and say, I'm going to bypass the sequencer and post my transaction on-chain. Now,
that's if you have but that's only if you have fraud proofs, no?
Well, the forced inclusion that you can actually, so if the sequencer doesn't and you can force it to include, right, you could technically have a forced inclusion probably without fraud proofs, but I don't know how you'd enforce it. But there may be some design there. But certainly the validators are only, certainly the validation is only if you have fraud proofs. The fact, so in some of these other systems that you sort of alluded to before that don't have fraud proofs, it works very differently. There are no validators because there's no mechanism for them to engage or become, there's no recourse. So there's no system of validators. The sequencer is the dictator in that case, right? So the sequencer doesn't only say, hey, here are the transactions. The sequencer also says, and by the way, here is the result. So it turns out the sequencer saying, yeah, Steven's wallet, you know, minus one ETH, Santiago's wallet plus one ETH. That's all done by the sequencer. So the sequencer decides to just like make stuff up and like take money out of my wallet, it can do that. If the sequencer decides to push bad transactions that aren't valid, it can do that if you don't have a set of validators. So that's why I think, and that in these other systems, that role is played by the sequencer. And that's why I think when a lot of people say decentralized sequencer, they're not thinking about the important but more narrow issue of, hey, can we have a distributed protocol that, you know, makes the sequencer not reorder? And by the way, we're working on that. We're collaborating with Espresso Systems on that. Mm-hmm. It's a high priority to get that. But like, I think that's like a relatively smaller issue than, you know, not having validators and the sequencer basically serves as a dictator. And I think people sometimes confuse those two.
Again, and why would you attribute to, like, I appreciate some of the criticisms I've heard about Arbitrum is this point around you have to trust this group of validators, which is a fair point. Look, I mean, you're progressively. But it's way better than systems that don't even have this group of validators. Again, the question is, like, why hasn't, like, Optimism, some of these other players, like, why haven't they built this group of validators? And, I mean, I appreciate maybe they have recently, but it took them a long, long time. Like, I'm just kind of curious, like, what makes it so hard?
I don't think they have, I think on mainnet they still have.
It's on testnet, I believe.
Yeah, so, right. So on mainnet, they don't have any fraud proofs that are deployed, to my knowledge. And I think they're working on it, and I hope that they're working, that they'll be successful. I really do. And I know that they have a lot of, you know, good people trying to work on this. So I think there are two things to say. Number one is, it's actually really complex. You know, there was an interesting thread on Twitter, which I know because I lived it, but it actually just I saw a few days ago, which actually went through some of the history of fraud proofs. And the answer is actually, if you go back 2 or 3 years, they did build it. There was this historic debate between two different types of fraud proofs. There was what we call interactive fraud proofs. That's what was in the initial Arbitrum paper, and we've always been building. And then there was what's called one-shot fraud proofs. And we were always in the interactive camp. And they were in the one-shot camp. They actually built one-shot fraud proofs and deployed them on mainnet, I think, in like 2019, 2020 or 2020 or so, or maybe 2020, 2021. But they had like critical bugs in it, so they had to turn them off. So they sort of, you know, the community and everyone sort of aligned to, okay, Arbitrum's method of interactive fraud proofs is the correct way to do fraud proofs, and everyone's aligned in that. And then I think they've been building ever since. And I know that they've had, you know, some progress recently. Again, I'm hopeful that they do this, but I think it's like, if you actually look at the history, you can find like passionate debates between me, Harry, I think Vitalik's definitely gotten involved at times, on Twitter, on Reddit. going back to like 20, some good archives I should pull up one day, where like, you know, people were passionately debating these two different ways of building fraud proofs. And we were always, you know, and everyone's sort of come around to today to, okay, this is how you build fraud proofs, which is interactive fraud proofs, the fraud proofs that sort of, you know, we've been building since the initial Arbitrum sketch in 2014. But it's not that they haven't tried or even deployed something. It's that sort of, you know, they, I guess, in the consensus view now, went down the wrong path and retraced and are now going down a different path, which is, you know, the path that we went down.
Has anyone tried to, Juan, have you thought about open sourcing this interactive fraud proof tech? Have people try to look at it and copy it as opposed to try to build their own flavor of it?
So the code has always been public and source visible, right? So anyone can look at it. You know, I have no knowledge of anyone trying to copy it, but I haven't really like dug too deeply into trying to figure that out, but not to my knowledge. But definitely some of the core ideas, which are not part of the code. So I'll give you an example. You know, one of the one of the big protocol breakthroughs that we figured out back in 2021 was to use chess clocks as part of this protocol. And I remember, like, you know, being very involved and I, you know, in this and having this idea of, hey, use chess clocks. The idea is you have two challengers and they have like variable timers. Before that, we thought that everyone sort of had a fixed timer, and it became problematic because the protocol just got very long. Like, everyone had this clock. And then it was like this aha moment. I remember it like very well. I was like, oh, why don't we just use chess clocks? And actually, this came to me when I was watching this movie. I forget, it was a Netflix like chess documentary about this. I forgot what it was called. Do you remember I'm talking about? There's like this girl.
Well, it's not a documentary. It's a show.
Not documentary. Right? Sorry. The short series. Yeah.
Queen's Gambit.
Queen's Gambit. So I'm watching the Queen's Gambit, and that's when like this idea came and like, okay, chess clocks, that's the answer. Boom, we got it, we figured it out. And now if you look at like every competitor's protocol, they all talk about chess clocks, which is fine, right? That's not like, you know, it's not part of the code, it's not a patented idea, it's just the idea. But my point is, there are definitely like, the ideas have been shared, you know, like Arbitrum has been pioneering interactive fraud proof since 2014. And like, you know, it is the ideas and the years of work that we put in it is no question contributing to every protocol that's building interactive fraud proofs today, but that's fine, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually a good thing in my opinion. The exchange of ideas. And I think, you know, as an ecosystem, I'm in favor of collaborating more and building things, you know, and finding shared resources. So that's like no issue. But like in terms of the other question of, so the code is visible today, but it's, and you can use it as part of the Arbitrum Orbit program, which means if you're building a layer two and you want to use it, all you have to do is join the Arbitrum Orbit program. You can use the Nitro technology stack. You can use the fraud proofs and, you know, no problem. You can use it. So yes, it's visible. Yes, we thought about open sourcing it, but we believe the best model is community source. So, and dozens of chains are using this today. These are layer threes, these are layer twos, are using the Arbitrum Orbit technology. And if a competitor wanted to go ahead, you know, if a competitor on a different stack today wanted to go ahead and say, hey, Arbitrum, you know, we just want to use your fraud proofs, they would absolutely be able to do that if they just complied with the Orbit licensing program.
Okay, so we need to find validators.
They'll need to find validators, it, or they can launch Arbitrum Bold, mm-hmm. Which will sort of be open to mm-hmm. open to everyone.
All right, I mentioned them in the pre-roll. Now I'm going to bring them up again. It's Arbitrum. Santi and I are really fed up with these high fees, and we're really excited to have teamed up with Arbitrum for the next couple of months on Empire. As the leading Ethereum scaling solution, Arbitrum now powers hundreds of decentralized apps across DeFi, perps, NFTs, gaming, and a whole lot more. The team has showed us everything in the ecosystem, both now and what's to come, and we're really, really excited about it. Arbitrum allows both daily users and developers to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. The way the team got me excited was through portal.arbitrum.io. So my call to action to you is to get started by visiting portal.arbitrum.io. Go experience on-chain like it was meant to be. This episode is brought to you by Monad. Monad's thesis is simple. The EVM is here to stay, similar to JavaScript and Web 2, but unfortunately, today's EVM lacks the high performance and the scalability that developers need to make certain applications possible. Monad addresses these concerns and these bottlenecks while preserving seamless EVM composability for application developers. There's a seamless transition to Monad as the Ethereum RPC API allows for really easy portability. And for developers, Monad can support 10,000 real transactions per second with their unique parallel execution environment. And of course, there's full compatibility with EVM bytecode. Monad's internal DevNet is live. Public testnet comes out soon. You can join Monad's journey in two ways. One, go follow them. They're on Twitter at Monad, M-O-N-A-D underscore XYZ. And also join the Monad Discord. It's discord.gg/Monad. Big thanks to Monad for sponsoring Empire. Hey everyone, Jason here. I know you've been hearing a lot about the intersection of crypto and AI, and that's why I'm really excited to share our newest partner and sponsor at Empire, Scale, a high-performance modular blockchain that's revolutionizing gaming and AI. With zero fees and instant finality, Scale's unique architecture allows for massive scalability and has already saved users over $6 billion in gas fees. The five main takeaways that you need to know for Scale. One, zero gas fees. Two, Scale has instant finality and lack of MEV. Three, the zero gas fee model of Scale is really important for blockchain gaming adoption as gamers don't have to pay transaction costs or have the SKL token. Four, Scale is multi-chain. This design allows for nodes to be combined to create chains and for individual subnodes to actually be removed and relocated, which creates greater security and collusion resistance. And five, Scale has become a really good fit for AI dApps because they're fast, automated, zero fee transactions. Big thank you to Scale for sponsoring Empire. We're excited to partner with you guys. Bridge over to Scale if you're listening to this at scale.space/ecosystem. Follow the journey along with Scale on X at Scale Network. That's at Scale Network. Big thanks again to Scale for sponsoring Empire.
I want to take us back to just the builder mindset. We've discussed a lot about the trade-offs, the decision tree process of building your own app chain, your L2, using Arbitrum or just your L3. What would you say to someone that may just come in and say, hey, like this kind of L2, L3 bridging sounds really complex from the user standpoint. Why don't I just go build in some of these higher throughput chains like Solana, Sui, say Aptos, Monad down the road? Like, what would you say to that?
Yeah, so I'd say a few things. Number one is like, I think the entire space is one of experimentation. So you're not going to hear me say a bad word about like these guys, you know, they're taking a different approach. They're trying a different thing. I can tell you why I think the Ethereum approach I think is a better idea. I think it will live out longer. But like, you know, Solana is a differentiated experiment. There's no question about it. They're trying something else, and they have a really great, you know, community that's building this with them. And there's no question about that. That I have, you know, I think that they are definitely doing something interesting. Do I think it's the quote unquote right thing? No, I think that, you know, Ethereum finds itself on a different point of this trade off when it comes to decentralization, you know, the requirements to run a node, the stability of the core layer one technology. I like those benefits of Ethereum more. And I think that it's worth the sort of trade-offs. But the point is, I'm also pragmatic about this. So, you know, in 2022 or so, we were having a lot of conversations with gaming teams. And they were saying, like, we can't come to Arbitrum One. It's just too expensive. Right? Because we were at that point, say 90 to 95% cheaper than Ethereum. And while like a couple of cents per transaction fee is like great for a DeFi app, because, you know, you can trade $100 and like your fee is 5 cents, that's perfect. Right? So even for like moderate size trades, it was like really, really great. But like if you're a game and you're paying a couple cents every time you do an on-chain transaction, a gaming transaction, that gets very expensive very quickly. So we understood that well. And what happened was these people were all going elsewhere. They were leaving Ethereum and going elsewhere. And that's where the sort of Arbitrum Nova came in. That's where we said, okay, we need an alternative DA solution. We need something that gets them the most of the benefits of Ethereum, but also gets them to the price point where they can be. And the idea was, because it wasn't like we were sitting in like our ivory tower saying, Ethereum, guys, you got to build an Ethereum. I don't care if it's more expensive. Like, you need, they're like, all right, well, I can just shut down shop because no one's going to play my game if I'm going to pay. It just won't work. It's not fun. It's not interesting. I won't have a community. And you have to sort of meet, you know, those two things together. And my point is, like, you know, if you look at Ethereum before layer twos like Arbitrum, or even if you look at, you know, layer twos like Arbitrum before EIP 4844, I think we're about to do it again with Arbitrum Stylus. You know, we're about to reduce fees significantly again for those apps that use Stylus. Like, at each point, there are points where teams can say, like, you might have a great reasons, you know, Stephen, why I should use this technology, and you can like lecture me on that. But like, if it doesn't meet the price point of my users, if it doesn't actually get me to where I need to be on a business standpoint, it doesn't matter. The conversation is not worth having, and that's why I think we've narrowed that gap massively. And today, because of the work we've done, you know, as layer two teams, but also as layer one teams, you know, building EIP 4844, building the Ethereum rollup centric roadmap, building Arbitrum, you know, building out the core technology, it becomes a lot easier for a lot of teams to say, you can build on a layer two or layer three, but ultimately be secured by Ethereum, building the Ethereum ecosystem. And you don't have to sacrifice. You don't have to make those sacrifices today. Cause I get you. I get that if like it was like 10x more expensive, you're probably better off on an alt layer one because it's better for you. Like we get that. And I never judge a team for saying that. But our job was, okay, how do we narrow that gap? How do we meet people and say, okay, you can actually have your cake and eat it too. You can be an Ethereum, but you can also run a business and not have to worry about, you know, being outcompeted by someone else, alt layer one. I'm not saying that, you know, we'll see how the fees ultimately land with Ethereum. There's still some market dynamics that, you know, may change over time, particularly as more usage comes up and more demand for blob space. There's a lot of open questions, but I think we've done a very good job narrowing that gap. Mm-hmm. So teams that care about Ethereum don't have to make the ultimate sacrifice, if you will, to build there. They're actually able to succeed and build there at the same time.
How, and this is my last question on this point, Jano, I'm sure you have others, but how important do you think composability is?
I think composability is very important for a lot of applications, probably less important for others. And I think this is, you know, to Jano, your question before, if do I want to build my own chain or do I want to build an application on Ethereum? So one of the things which I said before is, why do you want your own chain? But the other thing, question you should ask yourself is, do you need composability? What level of composability do you need? Do you need synchronous composability? Do you just need asynchronous composability or really good bridging? But I think it depends. So I'll take DeFi, for example. I don't see mm-hmm. DeFi like fragmenting because I think there is a network effect there. Right? The fact that you have, you know, $19 billion in TVL and Arbitrum today is very attractive for DeFi protocols. The fact that, you know, you have every other DeFi protocol in Arbitrum 1 today is a great, really attractive. If I'm building a DeFi protocol, I want to worry about one thing. How do I build the best product that will attract, you know, this existing user base to my app? What I don't want to worry about is I want to build a great product, and now I have to figure out how to get users on the chain in the first place and get liquidity here. And then once they're here, I got to, you know, it's just like, you don't want to deal with that. You want to be composable with other apps. You want to be with the user. And the same thing's for gaming, by the way, too. There's a trade-off here, right? So some games might be like, okay, you know, we want our own chain because we don't care about composability. Others might be, well, we want discoverability of our game. We want to be co-aligned. So it really depends on what the game is, you know, how in-game assets are used. Are they bridged? You know, where do they need to live? There are lots of different questions, but ultimately some applications need lots of composability. Others can live on an island. And DeFi is certainly in the composability first bucket. Gaming can go either way, but you can definitely imagine a game that doesn't care about being on a little bit isolated, right? It doesn't want to be too isolated, but like it's just like an extra click, and then like users can get funds there. Okay, fine. You know, that's pretty fine for many games. So it really depends on the application, but also on the flavor of the vertical, right? So different verticals will have different tolerance for composability.
And I said it was my last question, but I am curious just to get your thoughts around. Why do you think Coinbase chose the OP stack, particularly all the things that we've talked about, fraud proofs and everything else? Like, how is that? Give us some insight into that process, because people are really excited about it. Obviously, Coinbase is playing a big role, and they built some really good tech, their wallet and whatnot. But I'm curious why they didn't build on Arbitrum.
So I can't speak for them. I don't know why they didn't build an Arbitrum. I don't believe that you know, before the decision was made, you know, I wasn't involved in a conversation where they were seriously considering it. So I don't really have those details. I don't know if, you know, of a diligence process that we were a part of, but I'm sure that they, you know, took on considerations internally. The other thing is, you know, which they've been very public about, to their credit, there was, you know, Coinbase got I think it was something like 2.75% of the OP token supply for that decision. So there was definitely a financial aspect to it, which again, you know, they've publicly disclosed, and I could be wrong on the exact number, but that's you know, in that ballpark of my recollection, that's a lot of money today, in the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. So I think there were probably a lot of factors at play. But the interesting thing is, like, moving forward, you know, Coinbase obviously is on the OP stack, and, you know, Base is built on the OP stack, and that's sort of, you know, just is what it is. But I think that there are really interesting things happening on layer three, where the Arbitrum stack is not only powering a layer three as an Arbitrum one, it's actually powering, as I mentioned in the beginning of the pod, the Degen. Biggest layer three is on Base, like a Degen chain is an Arbitrum Orbit chain. So I think there are actually, you know, what happened in the past, I would call water under the bridge at this point. But going forward, I think that there are a lot of compelling cases where, you know, and it could actually make sense, right? There are certain, you know, Coinbase obviously has a great brand, and there are certain applications, you know, certain verticals they're going to go after. And you know, you might see some developer that says, hey, I want to be on Base, but I also want to have the best technology for my layer three. And that's fine. I think Arbitrum One obviously has, you know, its strong points, and it's, you know, the leader in DeFi, the leader in gaming today. But there definitely could be and will be chains like Degen Chain that say, hey, we want to build on Base. And, you know, what we say as a community, as, you know, me as part of the developer community, but also part of the broader community, is we support that. And, you know, we'd love ways to scale Ethereum more generally. So it doesn't have to just be, you know, our goal is to scale Ethereum and to really make the Arbitrum stack useful for, you know, scaling Ethereum generally. And super excited to see the many, many ways that it's been used.
Santi, you want to know the reason? I'm going to get a lot of shit for saying this. Study Andreessen Horowitz.
I think Coinbase Ventures made a Vulture Investor in Optimism. I forget. But yes, certainly A16Z has.
Coinbase Ventures actually invested in us as well.
But I still remember, like, it was, they certainly rolled out the red carpet for Optimism and withdrawals, and it took them longer for Arbitrum. But not to go down this rabbit hole further, I do, just as a follow-up, in this scenario of Degen chain, in a world where, like, if you're at app that is deploying an L3 using the Arbitrum stack, but using Optimism as an L2, how does the fraud proofs in the current state actually work? Because Optimism doesn't have them, but you may be using an L3 where you're using the tech that has it. So kind of like my brain's been fried.
So the number one is, it depends on the configuration of your chain, right? The Arbitrum Orbit stack says you can use fraud proofs, but, like, you know, you can also deploy your chain where you just have one validator who's yourself. I'm not saying that you do, by the way, that they do. I'm just saying, so for any Orbit chain, you have to not just look at the tech stack says what you can do. It doesn't say what is automatic, right? So just because someone's using the Orbit chain doesn't mean that they have a dozen validators that are independent. So you have to look at that always. I actually don't know exactly the configuration of Degen chain, so this is not like a comment on them. It's just a comment generally that you should look at the sort of the deployment of the technology, as well as the core technology. But assuming someone does, doesn't want to launch with, like, live fraud proofs and the like, and they have a nice set of validators, or, you know, they'll use Bold soon and they'll open up validators to everyone. What that means is, if you're a layer three on a layer two that doesn't have that, so you're just basically relying on the layer two to resolve your disputes, but they become sort of, your ultimate referee as well. So, right, the layer two may be centralized. So you have you'll have a decentralized protocol that when it sort of has a dispute, it will ultimately be resolved by the rules of the layer two. And if that's centralized, then ultimately that means your referee will be centralized. So it's kind of could lead to some, funny cases. But I think, you know, in the long run, ideally the layer twos that are, you know, powering layer threes will themselves ultimately be decentralized, and everything will sort of be flowing down to Ethereum. That's at least the goal. But certainly you can imagine combining these technologies in ways where the decentralization ends up at a centralized point.
Yeah. You always look further down at the stack where the settlement is happening. And if the security, that's like the weakest link, so to speak. If there are no security farther down the stack, you're kind of screwed.
Exactly. So your path to Ethereum is the weakest link from the layer three, you know, down to Ethereum. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Steven, if we fast forward a couple, so we have layer threes now, people are going to build on the layer threes. So then there'll be L4s. When does that game end, or does it not end? And that's totally fine.
So I think a lot of the core benefits. So if you remember those two things I rambled on earlier on, those two core benefits of building layer threes, the interesting thing is those, like, you basically get all of that from being a layer three. If you build a layer 4 or 5 or 6, it doesn't really buy you much. And just to recap, those two things were the 99% reduction in onboarding cost. That's because, layer twos are already get you there. Layer threes aren't 99% cheaper than layer twos. There are other reasons to get you there, like this, right? So the idea is you're not going to have that benefit on layer 4 or 5 or 6. You'll have the same benefit as layer three, but it doesn't sort of compound that way. And similarly, taking the bus to Ethereum, the same thing happens. You can join the bus from a layer three or a layer four or layer five, but you're not getting like a compounding benefit. So I actually think that layer three is where those benefits stop. And I don't see us going to layer 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I do think you'll see layer fours, and I'll tell you why, but I think that's where it basically, will likely stop. You'll see ecosystems building, because the one thing we didn't discuss is the other reason why to have layer three is, say you're building a gaming chain today. And your goal is not to just build a game, it's built a universe of chains. Or say you're doing this in whatever, it could be in any space, right? Where we see a bunch of chains, like Treasure, for example, plans to have many chains. Proof of Play talks about a multi-chain world as well. So eventually, you're going to have sort of many, many different chains that are part of one ecosystem. It could be in gaming, it could be something else. It makes sense to sort of glue those together, right? To have sort of one base chain. For these, and then to have all these other chains that are part of that ecosystem. Maybe every game has its own chain, right? So they're all sort of
like Nintendo would be the L3, and then all the other franchises would be the L4.
Exactly, something like that. And the idea then becomes that, so you might see that happen where some chain deploys as an L3 because they want the 99% cheaper onboarding, because they want that taking the bus to Ethereum, but now they want to build an ecosystem of chains, so it makes sense to go up to layer four. But it's not like the core benefits, like the compounding lower cost, won't happen, right? So that's why I think you're not going to be like, oh, I'm building a layer four because it's 99% cheaper than layer three. That I don't see happening. That's true for layer three to layer two. I don't believe that it really extends up. So I think it's not going to sort of go on forever. Mm-hmm. But this ecosystem thing you might see. So a layer three might have layer fours. And maybe at some point you'll see one of these layer fours, like Nintendo, has 100 of these others. And then there's some other game that now became a platform. So you might see things like that happen, but I think that will be driven mostly from ecosystem dynamics more than technology dynamics.
I actually think an analogy could, the way I've been thinking about it is this development of from SaaS to platform. So for people who use Salesforce or HubSpot as their CRM, for example, these were just SaaS brands that eventually had so many users and so many customers, they started to transition from a SaaS company to a platform where you could build something on top of them. And in this case, it's kind of maybe AWS is the L2, Salesforce is the L3. They're fine being an L3 for years, but once they get big enough, they then have these apps or L4s or whatever on top of them.
Exactly. And maybe, who knows, maybe 10 years down the road, one of those apps will be big enough that it becomes its own platform.
Exactly.
But that's going to be driven exactly by those dynamics, as opposed to and this is something that a lot of the alt L1 folks on Twitter don't understand. Every time you say L3, they're like, haha, L4, L5, L6, which is like they don't understand that L3 actually makes a lot of sense from a core dollars and cents perspective. L4s and 5, it could grow that way if a team wants it to, but it's not you just get this infinitely compound. If that was the case, we just jump straight to L100 and just okay, look, we just reduce fees to -1. You get paid to use the chain, right? That's not
just seems so. I asked this question, and then there's a few, I think ETH Maxis had just thought that it was a stupid question. So I'll ask it anyways, because I don't care what they think. At what point does Nintendo realize that it's just better to launch their own L1? And the reason I ask this is because we're asking these questions in a state of the world where we don't have mainstream applications, right? We have there's always this tragedy of the commons, right? So in a world where you have, you're an L3, you have a ton of demand, millions of users, then you're what's stopping me from going down to the L2? And then why do I stop there? Why do I not go to and build my own L1? And like, I know this is a broader debate, which may go down like a huge rabbit hole, which is bootstrapping. What are the requirements of like starting an L1, finding validators, security, all that. But I'll front run and just say, if you have like a ton of demand, ton of users, you're probably going to be solving some of the other stuff fairly trivially, I think. If you have that, because you'll attract validators because the fee pot's huge and people want to validate on your chain. Like, so I'm sure you thought about this. I'm curious if you have an opinion.
So from like L3 to L2, actually might make sense because those arguments that I gave you before, and there are more arguments, but like, let's just focus on those of like much, you know, 99% cost reduction on onboarding. That was because of the assumption we made that said, you're not going to have centralized exchange support on day one. But if you're like a massive brand, if you're Nintendo, I'm pretty sure you can get, you know, if Nintendo actually wants to launch an Arbitrum Orbit chain, I'm pretty sure it can get centralized exchange support on day one. Like that would be like pretty solid. I take that bet. And the other one, which is like, you know, reduce your get on the bus. That's only, again, the benefit of that is in a world where you're going to have spotty usage, you don't know your usage. If Nintendo comes down and build a chain, they probably know that they'll have, you know, pretty good consistent usage of their chain. They'll be able to sort of guarantee that or, you know, pay the cost up until when that happens. Like, I don't think that's going to be a massive worry for them. So it could be for a big brand like Nintendo, those two things don't apply. And they'd be like, hey, it makes sense for us to be a layer two, or there's no reason not to be a layer two. When you get to layer one, though, I don't think they're going to, you know, really, you know, want to get it. You know, you mentioned like bootstrapping. Like, I don't think it really makes sense to want to get into that business of like now building, you know, dealing with all that. You sort of, it's like, you could take Ethereum's consensus out of the box and use it and just focus on building the chain, or you can now try to like build like, you know, proof of stake program and like track validator.
Well, you use Tendermint, like DYDX. And then, you know, in a world where there's a lot of restaking, you could kind of maybe use even Ethereum as part of your security, like what Ethos is trying to do into Cosmos, right? Taking eigenlayer ETH restaked and then use it to bootstrap the security to incentivize validators and presumably lower the cost to get your own app chain started.
You absolutely could. So yeah, there you could, and that's not going to be quite, you know, we'll see how these services develop. I can tell you today, that's definitely not quite as simple as just building a layer two and using Ethereum, but definitely, you know, the ecosystem could develop in a way that is. But I'd argue that in all likeliness, so there's still going to be an uphill battle for you to sort of get that level. Because even, you know, restaking Ethereum means you get to borrow some of the security of Ethereum, but you're not going to be on the level of the entirety of the security of Ethereum. You'll get to borrow some of the Ethereum security to secure your chain, mm-hmm. because Ethereum will still be more secure. But anyway, maybe you don't care that much about security. Maybe that's not your, you being this hypothetical chain, maybe that's not your top thing. But the other thing I would say is, the other way to look at this is like, I think it's kind of, think about the internet for a second, right? The internet, like, you know, we're here, you know, streaming on the internet, and there are like multiple layers of internet stack beneath us, right? So we have like, you know, HTTPS, and we have, you know, TCP/IP. We have like, you know, lots of protocols going on underneath us and layered to us. And at some point, you know, I think these things should be abstracted away that you don't think about them that much, right? So you say, I want to launch my chain. Nintendo's not like thinking about like, I want to launch my chain on the internet, which in this case means on Ethereum. And that's just sort of the core infrastructure. But like from a user, whether it's an L2 or an L1 or an L3, like the users shouldn't have to engage with it that much. And this should just be, okay, it's secured by Ethereum chain, but I sort of interact with it as a first class citizen, right? I don't think about like, today you don't have that because I got to go to Coinbase, I got to go to Ethereum, I got to go to Arbitrum. You say you're very much interacting this layer. I think one of the things of interop we need to do in UX is to sort of abstract that away from users. The way we don't go ahead and say, okay, I want to build like, you know, a streaming service. So let me, why don't I reinvent the internet? Like that's like,
yeah, no one's building the entire stack. I hear your point. I was thinking about that while I was asking the question. The distinction here is, though, is that the value accrual at different parts of the stack, it's much more lucrative and attractive from an incentive standpoint that wasn't possible in the internet.
That's true.
Might change the dynamic. I do agree. Like, it's not your core competency. Why build an HTTPS 2.0? Like, no, right? At some point, these things become standards.
That's true. And you will need to choose a part of the stack. But my point is, like, I think the value accrual on layer two is good. And I think it just sort of abstracts away a lot from you. And then, like, we're going to get to a point where, like, again, like this whole conversation of like the stigma involved different layers, that's because like the layers are so much in your face. So if I'm a chain that's thinking about building a layer three today, their users are going to be like hyper aware of like, okay, I have to climb three rungs to get here. Actually, we're building like something internally, a tool which will allow you to jump directly from Ethereum to layer three. It's like a bridging tool. But the idea is anyway, like today, like these things are very early. So your users like are very hyper aware of where they are, of what they are, where they sit in the stack. But I think if we're successful, and this is ironic, but if we're successful, it's ironic because like for me to say, because you know, I sit here and I'm building one of these sort of things that are sort of in the infrastructure level. But the truth is, if we're successful, like mass market successful, which I think, you know, we as a community have been, but we still have ways to go. A lot of this will get abstracted away. So the user won't be thinking about like, am I on layer one, layer two, layer three? All they're going to be thinking about is I'm on Nintendo right now. And I know the Nintendo chain is secure. I've read that. I trust, you know, my source that this is a secure chain, but I actually don't even know exactly what layer I'm on right now. I just know that I open up my wallet and I can get my funds to Nintendo chain in one click. I can get them back to whatever other chain I want to in one click as well.
I want to end this discussion with just your overall take on one particular thing that I've thought about a lot is like, how would you define network effects in crypto?
Yeah. So I think, you know, we're obviously learning a lot, definitely as an ecosystem, as we see, you know, different application verticals pop up and, you know, sometimes get disrupted. But I think there are definitely lots of network effects on the infrastructure layer, for sure, on the sort of chain layer, I'll say. Where does that happen? Liquidity is definitely one. And so I'll give you, I used to say this, like, I always talk about security. And the truth is, though, that maybe only 20% of users care about security. I made that up. But like, let's just assume that 20% of users care about security. But there's a network effect here because of synchronous composability, right? The fact that you can build apps that talk to each other in a single transaction, you do multiple apps, the fact there's shared liquidity, there's a network effect here. So if my better security solution can attract those 20% of users and your 80%, but your solution will alienate those 20%, but only to be the 80%, then we're better off using the more secure one because we're actually going to be able to get a much larger network. So I think particularly, you know, one of the magical things about, you know, DeFi, for example, right? You know, DeFi summer was just the fact that you can just take building blocks and compose them. Anyone can go ahead and just like launch an app that directly ties into this monetary system. And they can also, you know, tie into not only the core liquidity, but to other, you know, they can, you know, build a pool on Uniswap, right? They can actually tie into other pieces as well. So I think that there are very, very big network effects on the chain level. Particularly in applications that require liquidity. And you know, this is something which we're obviously seeing play out. But that's very, very clear to me. And I think that's actually as we see now increased CeFi, if you will, or like TradFi coming on board as well, they're also looking very, very much to this, right? So, you know, Arbitrum has seen a bunch of launches from, you know, more traditional finance companies, including Franklin Templeton, Robinhood, Centrifuge is building their liquidity pools there. And I think that the ultimate goal for TradFi is to tie into some of these really nice, you know, network effects and things that you can do synchronously. And I think over time, we'll probably see a merging there between TradFi and DeFi. Not a full merging, obviously, but like, you know, we'll see them merge in a significant way.
Yeah. I think that's a really good response and a good way to end it. There are folks that have said that like most crypto networks have anti-network effects. And I think they're focusing on the fee degradation, the more users that come. Even if you have composability, even though you have security, it, when you look at it on the lens of fees, right, we're all go back to the days where an L1, you're paying like thousands of dollars in Ethereum to settle a transaction. Then obviously that has anti-network effects as you scale, but with recent improvements, you know, 4844 and other scaling solutions, you know, like L2s, L3s, then I think that takes the backseat. And the more important thing is the user experience, right? Where fees at some point, like the marginal improvement in fees is not so much as important, whereas the network effect becomes like more so the composability, the ecosystem of apps that you're seeing. And so I think it's a good way to put it in seeing kind of how, what has been built in Arbitrum, right? But like a year or two ago, you would have said, yeah, most crypto, like certainly Ethereum had anti-network effects at the L1. Like it was just really bad.
Yeah, I think this is where like actually separating out verticals is really important, because the problem was, if you go back a few years ago, was everyone was competing for this Ethereum layer one block space. And like, you know, as soon as CryptoKitties or one app got successful, it sort of, you know, ruined the experience for everyone. And you know, the analogy that I like to give is like TV channels, which is obviously a dated analogy at this point, but I think it's useful, which is if you had like one channel and every TV program was supposed to go there, every show was going to give this channel, like it would be terrible, right? It wouldn't work. You'd be alienating, you know, you'd never get find someone that speaks to your audience, and it would just be terrible. If you had like, and in the other extreme, if you had every TV show had its own channel, it would also be terrible, because there would be like no discoverability. I can't just go and say, hey, I don't know what I want to watch now, but I like game shows. Like, well, there is no game show network. You can go to the particular network for this game show, and then, you know, good luck finding anything else. Or even like think about like advertising deals and distribution. Like every show would have to sort of negotiate those for themselves. What we'd have is like most of the day you'd have empty programming. What we actually have is you have grouping by vertical. So if you like cartoons, you have the Cartoon Network. You know, if you like nature, you'll have, you know, National Geographic. And the idea is that there might be like overlap here. Like you can have like a cartoon about nature, which could go either way. And will never be a perfect system where it's like obvious where everything goes 100%. But users will know where to go when they want to find something, and developers will know where to go. And I think that's what we're doing here. So the idea is like when you, and you know, this in response to like the sort of the anti-network effect is we need to sort of self-shard ourselves. I think that's a lot of what we're seeing in this world where L3s and more L2s are taking off, where you're going to have chains that are sort of specialized and specific for certain purposes. We have to find the right balance. Not that every app has its own chain, but every vertical sort of has its own chain or two. And I think that's going to help with a lot of those things. Because yeah, in a world where everyone's competing for that same single channel, like yeah, the fees are going to kill it. And it's going to be a terrible, you won't be able to scale. But in a world where you have multiple channels and paths, and you can sort of self-shard and self-organize around the ones where the same user set wants to be and is willing to pay for the fees associated with supporting that set of applications, you're going to probably find the right balance. And obviously we're still in the middle of this experiment, so we don't know exactly what will be, but that to me looks like, you know, the most promising path. And indeed, I think it's the path we're on with the proliferation of specialized, blockchains that we're seeing today.
I got four more minutes, so I'm going to squeeze one last question. Sorry, guys. just because Monad, and full disclosure, I'm an investor in both you and Monad, but I'm curious, what would you say to the criticism of, like, the EVM is flawed, it's single-threaded, let's parallelize it, let's have local fee markets, kind of like a Monad approach. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there was this interesting study, this post I saw from Polygon, where they basically, you know, it showed like for their workload and their chain, like what percent is parallelizable. And it turned out like it was like 50%, which means like even if you have perfect parallelization, like you're going to get like a 2x reduction. And that's fine. But I think that's number one, where like a lot of the hype that I see, and maybe I'm sure this team understands that. I'm sure that a lot of, you know, sophisticated people understand that. But I think probably most people sort of, when they think parallelization, think, okay, we're going to take one core and now we're going to have 64 cores and like, things are going to like go crazy, but it turns out a lot of the work just isn't parallelizable. And the reason for that is, by the way, a lot of times when something gets hot, it's the same thing that gets hot. Meaning if there's like a particular, you know, if the chain is like, you know, kind of dead and not, no one cares, and then it heats up, it's because there's that one NFT drop that everyone wants to hit that same contract right now. And parallelization is not going to help you there. You know, a localized fee market is not going to help you for that, because everyone's sort of going right there and then. But I do think that there is, you know, a case for there's definitely pros and cons for something like localized fee markets. Again, it won't help you in this case, but I also don't know that parallelization and localized fee markets have to be connected. That's another interesting thing. So I think you could build, technology. You can build, you know, the stack to sort of, you know, you can imagine a simple design where like you just have different allocation for different applications. You can't use too much. I'm not saying it's a better or worse design. I'm just saying these two things aren't tied at the hip. You can have parallelization. You can have local fee markets with or without parallelization is another thing. And I do think that, you know, the real answer is it's a broad question around changing the EVM and the community's conversation around that, which is, I think, one that we need to have as a community, because there's no one today that I don't think anyone in the world, not Vitalik, no one in the world that would say, I'm giving you a clean slate. We're going to roll back, you know, to 2015. Let's launch EVM again. Do you want to change anything? And I think everyone in the world today would say yes to at least something, right? There's a laundry list of things that we can't change because of backwards compatibility. So there's a broader conversation around, you know, right now, you know, a lot of L2s are, including Arbitrum One, are what we call Ethereum equivalent, that they literally don't deviate by design from the EVM. And there's a conversation there. But Arbitrum is actually taking a different approach where it's building Arbitrum Stylus to what we call EVM Plus. So the EVM is staying exactly as it is, not breaking, not changing at all. But in the same environment, you'll also be able to write Rust and C and C++ contracts and interact synchronously with EVM contracts. And you won't even and get a 10x reduction in cost of computational cost for doing that. So we are very much thinking of how do we expand and how do we afford more to developers and users without changing the EVM by adding to the EVM. And it might well happen that fast forward 10 years, no one's using, or most people aren't using the EVM on Arbitrum anymore. They're using something else, but the EVM is not going anywhere. That's our commitment because mm-hmm. like we're still not sure as developers and the community conversation, not mine, but like it's still not clear to me like that the community is ready to sort of, you know, change the EVM fundamentally. So that's the approach we've taken, which is yes, we want to innovate. But we also want to leave the EVM. So Stylus is mm-hmm. in the realm of EVM plus. It's keeping the EVM where it is.
Yeah. You can't change it because of backwards compatibility. There's some things you just can't change. Right.
Exactly. I mean, you could in theory, but yes, it's yes, it's
and social consensus. You would have to
exactly like it wouldn't be good.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to end it. I know we'd love to have you on. I mean, just have a as I think about like the next time because you're a repeat guest, and I think there's a few people out there that can actually understand given the history and how involved you are. But around this broader topic of resource allocation, I'd love to explore just how you think about like local fee markets. Like load balancing. I mean, these are things that like in the internet, like Netflix pioneer, like microservices, like a lot of things that have to happen in order for you to watch the same show, Queen's Gambit, everyone wants to watch it when it releases. How do you balance that load? Like this is networking thing. Like these are problems that, you know, engineers had to face when the internet was being built and as you scaled. And so I think it's no different in crypto, like resource allocation and pricing, right? Solana is having issues now because they need to figure out a better pricing mechanism, right? And kind of resource allocation mechanism. So these are growing pains for every network as you get scale. And the exciting thing is we're getting scale, like we're getting more and more users interested in using this tech. So it's not a bad problem to have. But I think to your point, I don't think anyone has solved it. But you know, the teams that are more agile, like perhaps you guys, are higher probability of solving it over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, happy to obviously, you know, come back and talk all about that. And yeah, there are a lot of open problems in the space and a lot of shared ground. We're all trying to solve some of the same problems. You have like a list of problems and like scaling was like number one. And I feel like scaling Ethereum, we've done a pretty good job there. And it's not like the list goes away. So now number two becomes number one. And, you know, some of these problems have just elevated and are now, you know, some of the most important things to think about in the space.
Awesome. Steven, as always, pleasure having you on. Thanks for taking the time and for bearing with our simplistic questions here.
Thank you for having me. Always love coming on.
Hey everyone, Jason here. Thank you so much for watching today's episode. Wanted to take a quick second to thank today's title sponsor, Arbitrum. We know you are tired of on-chain experiences that have unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds, and that's why we partnered with Arbitrum. You can experience frictionless trades, lightning speed, and lag-free transactions, all for pennies per transaction. Explore Arbitrum's expanding ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. That's portal.arbitrum.io. See you for the next episode.